We'll now proceed to the third case, the United States versus Johnson. Mr. Williams?
Good morning. May it please the court. Mr. Johnson's principal argument in the district court and his principal argument in this court is that his motion to suppress should have been granted. But to get to that issue, we have to first get past the government's argument that the issue was waived. That leads us to two preliminary matters. First, was the prosecution in the district court one case or two? If two, was Mr. Johnson required to refile his already fully litigated motion to suppress following a Speedy Trial Act dismissal and re-indictment? Now, in this case, the original indictment was filed in 2009. The Miranda-based motion to suppress was fully litigated in the context of that first filing, the 09 case. The magistrate judge held the hearing, recommended denial, district court upheld the denial. Done. Shortly after that, a Speedy Trial Act error was discovered. Both sides, both parties, moved to dismiss. Judge Randa, who had by now taken over the case from Judge Stattmuller, chose to grant the government's motion to dismiss and dismiss the indictment without prejudice. Of course, the government reindicted, and the second indictment was the mirror image of the first. Same issues, same counsel, same parties, same evidence. Now, as a clerical matter, I'm prepared to concede that we have two cases, simply because the clerk decided to assign different cause numbers to them. If you take the contrasting situation in a civil case, if a complaint is dismissed on 12b6 grounds and the plaintiff refiles the complaint, the amended complaint is, by the clerk's office, filed under the same cause number as the original complaint. I don't know why the practice is different between civil and criminal, but we do maintain that a decision by the clerk as to which cause number a case should bear should not determine the record on appeal and should not determine, as a matter of law, the question of waiver.
But, Mr. Williams, there was another arraignment, right? Another round of pretrial motion briefing.
There was a second arraignment, and the court set new deadlines for motions. But I would emphasize at no time put the defendant on notice that motions had to be refiled.
Sure, but it does suggest that there is a second case.
There are due process issues different in criminal cases than civil, I concede. But for purposes of determining the waiver issue, we maintain that the 10 case, the 2010 indictment, ought to be considered as a continuation of the 2009. I say this in part because of circuit precedent that holds that a Speedy Trial Act dismissal without prejudice is not a final order, is not appealable. If the dismissal is interlocutory, then it seems to me only logical that a re-indictment, which everyone knows is going to result, should be considered as the same case as the first. In addition, had Mr. Johnson's trial counsel attempted to relitigate the motion to suppress, Judge Stattmuller would have responded that his earlier ruling was law of the case, even though it was entered in the 09 case. We know that from the O'Neill decision from Judge Stattmuller that's cited in our reply brief.
Mr. Williams, but we have a new presiding judge, right, in the second case?
In the second case, Judge Stattmuller retakes the case, so we're back to square one there.
Yeah. So there was an opportunity for the new judge to revisit, right, the motion?
The new judge could have revisited the motion, but if Judge Stattmuller followed his own precedent, he would not have. Therefore, we contend that there was one case and no waiver or forfeiture. But even if we have two cases, we still have no waiver. Even if this court concludes that the two cases are separate, and even if this court concludes that Mr. Johnson was required to refile his motion, there simply cannot be a plausible argument that the failure to do so was deliberate in a way that would give rise to waiver. There's simply nothing to be gained by the defendant abandoning his principal argument, and the government simply doesn't suggest a strategic reason for doing that.
Mr. Williams, if we were to agree that there was no strategic waiver, if the 10 case was a second case and the defendant was obligated to refile pretrial motions, then there's still the Rule 12e waiver. Right? So Rule 12e says that if you don't file motions to suppress by the deadline, they're waived unless there's good cause. So wouldn't your client still have to overcome that waiver?
I think notwithstanding Rule 12e, according to this Court's jurisprudence on waiver versus forfeiture, we still do not have a waiver. At most, the issue is forfeited and ought to be reviewable for clear error. With that, I'd like to move to the Miranda-based suppression motion. Mr. Johnson was stopped by the police early in the morning on January the 27th of 2009, according to plan. Mr. Johnson was held handcuffed at the curbside and later inside the police patrol wagon, where he would remain for the better part of the morning and afternoon. We know that Mr. Johnson, by the time he got into the patrol wagon, was in custody. And we also know that he was interrogated, because there's evidence of that interrogation. Mr. Johnson himself testified, and I emphasize, without contradiction, that Officer Bolin asked him questions, including a question concerning the combination of a safe that was found upstairs in the home. Officer Henry, who was offered by the government to testify concerning the initial stop, also admitted that he heard Officer Bolin engage in conversations with Mr. Johnson, which Officer Henry said he could not hear. The government did not offer Officer Bolin as a trial witness. But the most important interrogation that took place that morning and afternoon took place in the patrol wagon. After Mr. Johnson was arrested, placed in the wagon, handcuffed, they didn't take him to jail. They took him back to the scene of the apartment search that was then in progress. And at that point, Officer Bolin got into the patrol wagon and read the warrant to Mr. Johnson. The warrant was at least 2 pages long. It was extremely detailed and told Mr. Johnson exactly what was being looked for. At this point, and according to the evidence, immediately after this point, Mr. Johnson made a critical admission. He said that everything in the apartment was his. That admission linked him to the crack cocaine inside, to the paraphernalia, to the scales. It was all the government needed to convict, and it was tantamount to a confession. So we have a carefully orchestrated sequence of events here. The traffic stop was pre-planned. It wasn't based on probable cause. The officers admitted that it was their practice to detain the subject of a search, and apparently even to detain the subject of a search when he's not at the scene of the search. That all happened here. All this
Williams, we have a problem. We don't have the record of the motion suppressed before us, do we?
We do not. I believe the merits panel has the authority to revisit that ruling.
We would have to do that.
But at the moment, we do not. We do, however, have the trial record, and everything that I'm telling to the court this morning comes from the trial record in the 2010 case. All this planning, all this questioning was designed to elicit incriminating responses. We know this because it couldn't have any other purpose. There's no reason to transport Mr. Johnson back to the scene of the apartment where the search is going on. He could just as easily have been taken to jail, which is where he wound up. There's no reason to ask Mr. Johnson about the combination of a safe that the officers could have broken into anyway under the search warrant, and which they did break into. And most important, there's no reason to read him the warrant other than to put pressure on Mr. Johnson to say something to respond before Miranda warnings are given.
Would handing him a copy of the warrant also have constituted interrogation in your view?
No, I don't think so. I think it was the act of reading the warrant that made it immediate. Had the warrant simply been handed to him, he could have discarded it. He could have ignored it. It's very difficult to ignore the police officer reading you an official document like that. At least that's the distinction I see. The tactics here are very similar to the tactics that were used in United States versus Swanson, which is a case cited in our brief. Recall that in that case, Mr. Swanson was charged with possession of a sawed-off shotgun. The officers didn't come right out and ask him, do you have a sawed-off shotgun? Instead, they showed him a court order on which the judge hand-wrote an order to turn over firearms and continually emphasized the importance of complying with the court order. And eventually, Mr. Swanson produced that sawed-off shotgun and was charged for it. Here, we have a far more coercive set of circumstances. Mr. Swanson wasn't handcuffed. He wasn't kept in a patrol wagon all day. He didn't get a warrant read to him. But the point of the exercise in both cases was the same. And in this case, the point of this elaborate minuet, if you will, that the police officers went through with Mr. Johnson that morning was to elicit incriminating responses. By the time Miranda warnings were given after 5 p.m. that afternoon in the police station, the confession had already been given. Our contention is that Mr. Johnson's unwarned statements made in the patrol wagon tainted his later admissions in the post-arrest statement and that all should have been suppressed. I'd like now to move to the aiding and abetting instruction. The evidence in this case was very straightforward and admitted to only one of two possibilities. Either Mr. Johnson possessed crack cocaine with intent to distribute, or he did not. Those were the only two possibilities presented to the jury. But the aiding and abetting instruction, which was requested and granted at the very last moment after Mr. Johnson testified, introduced a third possibility. And that was that Mr. Johnson and the individual named Simon that Mr. Johnson testified lived in the apartment and was responsible distributing crack, that those two individuals actually worked together to distribute crack. Well, the government presented no evidence to support this theory, and I submit that it is not fairly inferable from what little Mr. Johnson's testimony added to that. The government denied that a Simon existed inside the apartment. The government told the jury that that Simon was imaginary, and that word imaginary was the government's word. It appears at page 220 of the transcript. And I think it's significant that the government never asked for an aiding and abetting instruction on the strength of its own evidence. It was only after Mr. Johnson testified. For that matter, the court's preliminary instructions did not include an aiding and abetting instruction. Now, the government now contends, which it did not at trial. Well, it did at trial. The government now contends, but without evidence, that the individual Simon was Mr. Johnson's supplier. In the first place, that doesn't suffice to justify an aiding and abetting instruction under this court's Cologne decision. But there's no evidence that Mr. Simon, the individual Simon, sold anything to Mr. Johnson or that anyone else did either. There's no evidence of a buyer-seller relationship, but even if there were, it would not support an aiding and abetting instruction. Was the instruction unduly prejudicial? We contend yes. There was no evidence that if Simon existed, Mr. Johnson did anything to aid him. But the very fact that the government didn't ask for this instruction on the strength of its own evidence suggests that it couldn't have got it without some additional help.
When Johnson testified, what did he say about Simon?
Mr. Johnson testified that Simon lived in the apartment along with other individuals and that it was Simon who produced, cooked, and sold the crack cocaine, not him. But no evidence was presented by Mr. Johnson any more than by the government that the two were in league together.
But if Mr. Johnson permitted the Simon to sell from his apartment, wouldn't that justify an aiding and abetting instruction?
Well, in the first place, Your Honor, it was not Mr. Johnson's apartment. The apartment belonged to his fiancée. If the government had presented some evidence of some more active assistance by Mr. Johnson, then there might have been a basis for the instruction, but there was no such evidence.
Was he cross-examined on this issue?
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
Did the government ask those kind of questions?
From my recollection, no, Your Honor. I think the government asked enough to allow them to argue in closing argument that the Simon in the apartment was imaginary and that the real Simon was the supplier. I know the government did argue that. With respect to the two-level enhancement for obstruction of justice, the district court, which did not hear the trial evidence, relied on inconsistency alone. We think that's insufficient.
Mr. Williams. Ms. Koenig.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States in this appeal. I think it falls to me to say something about the recusals in this case, because I can see how someone unfamiliar with our district but versed in the law would read the opening brief in this case and be somewhat troubled that the district judge who recused himself in 0983 presided over the trial in 10-121. Excuse me. So I'd like to put that in a little bit of context for the panel. With as much diplomacy as I can muster. And what I'd like to say is that every relationship has a history, and that's true of the relationship between my office and Judge Stadtmuller. And the court is aware there have been two mandamus petitions filed by my office over the last 5 or 6 years. Judge Stadtmuller has recused himself frequently in situations where he perceives a policy difference with the Justice Department, for example, over cases involving fast-track programs in immigration cases. He has also recused himself more recently in cases involving particular AUSAs. What I want the panel to understand is that neither of the recusals in this case had anything to do with Mr. Johnson. And the first recusal, which occurred in 2009, occurred at a time when Judge Stadtmuller was in the process of taking himself off the draw for criminal cases. And some of the history of that is set forth in the newspaper article that I cited in a footnote. And the second recusal, which occurred very late in the second case, in April of this year, I believe, was prompted by a disagreement with my office over the applicability of the Fair Sentencing Act to Mr. Johnson's case. What you had was a letter from my boss on April 8th outlining our view that in light of the jury's finding of 280 or more grams of crack cocaine, it wasn't necessary to brief the Fair Sentencing Act retroactivity issue, and also pointing out that by that point in time, this court had decided the Fisher case. So all of that was moot. The very next docket entry on the same day is an order of recusal from Judge Stadtmuller. So I wanted to just give that context. Again, I'm not casting aspersions at anyone. That's why we have a process like this to sort things out. But I did think it important for you to know those things. Now, on the motion to suppress, as my opponent has laid out for you, we either have one case or we have two cases. When we were briefing this appeal, it certainly looked to us as though the second case was a new case with a new briefing schedule. And there are lots of situations in which it may seem futile to have to raise an issue. But you have to do it anyway. Actually, the Fair Sentencing Act retroactivity is a good example, as would be the defendant's argument on career offender in this case. You know you're going to lose, but you have to advance the argument to preserve it. So that's our position, is that we have two cases, not one. If it is one case, I would ask that the court allow the record to be supplemented and permit some additional briefing on this issue.
Yeah, we would have to, right, Scott?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Why do you think there's strategic or a deliberate waiver by the defendant? why wouldn't he re-raise the motion?
Well, I think principally he advanced a different argument. I think the judgment was made that the Miranda-based argument was not persuasive and it wasn't worth pursuing.
But isn't the alternative and possibly more likely inference to draw is that the defense counsel and the prosecutor and the court believed that the prior ruling stood?
Well, if that were so, it would be a simple matter to advance the argument, and everyone could say, I'm relying on what Judge Goodstein said in 0983. The other side could say, we're relying on our briefing in that case, and then the new motions judge could decide the issue. But there was, in fact, a new motions judge, as one of you noted. There would have been an opportunity for another hearing, presumably.
Kind of a tortured procedure below in this case.
Right. On the merits, again, I guess I really don't want to spend too much time on the merits because if you want to go there, I think you're going to supplement the record and tell us to go there. But it would come to as a great surprise to the agents in my jurisdiction that they're not allowed to read a warrant to someone whose house is being searched. That is a very, very common practice. And if it's found to be intimidating or coercive, on these facts, it will work a change in how search warrants are executed. On the aiding and abetting instruction, I would note that the defendant opened the door for Simon in this trial. The government wasn't going to go there at all. And what we have here is not the Cologne case, which, as I understand it, says a regular customer of a conspiracy or a drug dealer is not necessarily a co-conspirator or an aider and abettor. What we have here is a situation where the jury could have believed some combination of the government's evidence and what the defendant was saying. In other words, it doesn't have to be the case, an either-or, where Simon is a supplier on 16th Street or he's some other dude living in the house slinging dope. It could have been a combination. There were facts in the record that would have supported the jury's conclusion that these two men were selling dope together. And Johnson testified that he was, not in so many words, but he allowed that he was aware of what Simon was up to. And so that's what I'd like to say on aiding and abetting. Career offender issue, I think, is foreclosed by this court's decisions in Curtis and Rice. However, the Illinois statute is analyzed, whether it's under the residual clause or under the has as an element the use of force against another language. Those decisions foreclose the argument that the aggravated discharge crime doesn't count. And lastly, on the obstruction of justice, I would point out, first of all, that the issue would be moot if the court agrees with the government on career offender, because the enhancement would only get him up to level 36, and he was a 37 with career offender. But I would concede that Judge Randa's articulation of why the enhancement should apply was perhaps not the most artful formulation, but it's very clear that the judge did not simply assume that because the defendant testified at his trial and put the government to its proof that he therefore obstructed justice. It's very clear that the judge compared the defendant's post-arrest statements with his trial testimony and found that he committed perjury. And in short, he did the very best that he could as a judge who did not sit during the trial.
Right.
So we would ask you to affirm that aspect of the sentence as well as the entire conviction and sentence in this case. Are there any further questions from the panel?
Thank you
for your time.
Monique, Mr. Williams, I think your time had expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, the only additional comment I would make is that if the Court did choose to require additional briefing, I don't think the government should be permitted to argue the merits of the search, having already foregone it.
All right. Mr. Williams, I want to thank you and Mr. Koenig for your argument this morning, but I want to extend on behalf of the Court an additional thanks for your accepting representation in this case and ably representing Mr. Johnson. All right, the case is taken under advisement.